In November 2004, an intruder broke into a couple's Delmar home in the US, brutally axe murdering a man as he slept and critically injuring his wife. What appeared to at first be a burglary gone wrong, well, it soon turned into something even more sinister as police identified a family member as the prime suspect. This is what happens when a cold-blooded sociopath is raised as a member of the family. This is the case of Christopher Porco. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Thank you for joining me, my lovelies. Much appreciated. It's very cold at the moment. I am wearing a jumper because of this. It is nearly December if you're watching this at a different time and wondering why I seem to be requiring such appendages. Nonetheless, it kind of suits the case because we're talking cold-blooded today. Big shout out to all of you who supported me on Patreon and all of you who are supporting me on YouTube membership. You know how much it means. I can make the content because of that. And also to all of you who just come and visit, subscribe. If you haven't subscribed, subscribe. And just join me here. You are appreciated. Also, just to know, I am all over the UK. There will be an announcement because I will be going to the US, I think, next year, definitely 2024. So if you haven't seen my crime tour, then I'm going to be coming to somewhere near you, I would imagine, at some point, at least in those countries, England and the US of A. Let's get on with today's case. Wow, is what I'm going to say. Some of you may have heard of it before. It is disturbing. So let's take you back. 15th of December, 2004, it's 11:35 a.m. Michael Hart, he's a court officer, he arrives at the Porco family home. This is at 36 Broccoli Drive, Delmar, Bethlehem, New York. Now, Michael is a good guy. He's gonna throw it out there. Good guy. Why? Because Michael is a work colleague of Peter Porco. And when Peter didn't turn up for work, he was a court clerk, basically, because there was no explanation and it was literally completely out of character, Michael decided that he was going to go and check on him. Let's all admit it, the world needs more Michaels. So he arrives at the address, tries to get an answer. When he knocks on the door, no one responds. But he kind of wants to deal with that intuition, that instinct, which feels that something's wrong. So he ends up looking through the front door glass, and at this moment, he does genuinely feel anyway that something terrible must have happened, but then it's confirmed. So as he peers in, he sees that at the foot of the stairs was 52-year-old Peter's lifeless body, and that body is just surrounded in a pool of blood. It's evident even from looking in that he's suffered a number of catastrophic wounds to his head, to his face. At this moment in time, of course, Michael calls for backup, paramedics are on the scene, and the police notice that there's a screen in the garage door that's being cut. Evidently, that would be where a intruder had got in. Also, they instantly notice that an alarm box has literally been smashed up and the phone line's been cut. So this is all signs of a planned home invasion, a planned burglary. But this is the issue. When you look in the house, nothing's been stolen. Nada. Not one thing. And what they were actually met with inside was so far away from a regular burglary. And the reason for that is, listen, we all know that there are very occasional scenarios where burglars do actually use violence on the individuals who inhabit those homes. But it's really rare. Burglars that tend to steal things and leave, it's usually a opportunistic crime, and certainly we wouldn't expect to see some kind of mass murder. Burglars know there's a big distinction between actually taking stuff from somebody's property and killing somebody in that property. And also, there are trails of blood all over several rooms. So instantly, the police feel that this is more than a burglary gone wrong. The officers then go upstairs because they want to look for Peter's wife of 30 years, Joan. She's 54 years of age at the time that this has happened, and they find her literally so close to death. And I mean, barely alive. She's on the blood-soaked bed. And just like her husband, she's suffered these horrific head and facial injuries, and they really are absolutely distressing and disturbing. So she's lost her left eye. She lost part of her skull. So badly was her skull damaged that part of her brain was actually exposed. But she was still conscious. She was still somehow breathing. And lying alongside her on the bed was the weapon that had clearly intended to kill her and had managed to inflict these serious wounds I'm talking about. It was a fireman's axe. And that fireman's axe actually came from the family home. That's another concerning factor for anybody who's investigating crimes. We know that certainly when you think about opportunistic killers who are random, such as serial killers that are disorganized, they'll often go to a home without any weapons and then use something within the home. But a fireman's axe, you tend to have some knowledge of where that would be to actually utilize it. And if you're an organized killer or you're prepared to kill, you tend to go with something that you would use and feel comfortable using. So that kind of an axe killing, it says something intentionally rageful, doesn't it? It says something that's not just about killing, it's about absolutely eradicating, executing, decimating. And the fact that the injuries are also around the head, I don't think you can dehumanize more so than doing that to an individual. Now, it's unbelievable. It really is unbelievable because Joan, she's in a really life-threatening state. She's got these horrific injuries, but she still has the capacity at the crime scene in her home to communicate with the paramedics. They managed to stabilize her in that way so that she can have some communication. She can't speak, to be fair. Her jaw's been really badly shattered and dislocated. And he actually asks, the paramedic asks, if they've been attacked by a member of the family. And Joan slowly nods. Then they ask, was it their oldest son? That's 23-year-old Jonathan. And Joan shakes her head. And then they ask, had it been their youngest son, 21-year-old Christopher? And it's at this point she nods yes. So she, at this point, of course, is just rushed straight to hospital. She's placed in a medically induced coma. And sometimes people don't really feel that it's appropriate in these moments to ask questions like this, because obviously somebody needs to be taken to hospital immediately and their wounds and needs and survival is far more important than getting answers. But when you see somebody who looks like they are likely to die, the one thing on your mind is, how do I create justice and legacy within that justice for this person who's been so brutalized? That's why they ask those questions. I almost feel that sometimes it can seem like a little bit inhumane to do so, but actually it's quite the contrary. It's totally humane. It's about getting the information that they need to get to protect others, as well as making sure that somebody's brought to justice for these awful crimes. Now, unbelievably, Joan actually lives. Her life's saved at the hospital. She has this emergency surgery, but clearly from what I've described about the injuries, they were horrific, and she was left with facial disfigurement. She'd actually been struck at least 3 times with the axe. Remember, she loses an eye and her jaw had to be reconstructed. So we're talking about, from that moment in time, whoever looks in her direction will know that something terrible has befallen her. And when somebody is disfigured, don't get me wrong, the vast majority of people are highly empathic, compassionate and loving and understanding, but your face is part of your identity. It's the same when I've worked with people who've been victims of acid attacks. They feel like the individual has stolen who they were, because everyone gets used to the face that you have and the face that they interact with. And then all of a sudden it doesn't look like that. There's a distortion to that. You wear the crime on your face eternally in this lifetime. And that's very challenging on an emotional and psychological level. I appreciate people overcome these issues, grow in resilience, and are amazing advocates for helping us understand that beauty is skin deep. But still, to be in that situation is unenviable and highly challenging. When they do the autopsy, of course, on Peter, because he did very sadly lose his life, whoa, the ferocity of the attack that he endured is even greater. So he actually suffered a total of 16 axe wounds. That was to his head and jaw. One had completely sliced through his skull and penetrated his brain. Another had taken part of his jaw off. And this part is going to stun you. And to some degree, there will be a level of awe, because I think that we forget just how much the human body can sustain It's an incredible vehicle, and often we disrespect it, we don't appreciate it, we chastise it for not looking perfect. But actually, on a survival mechanism, our body is there and our brain is there to keep us going. And to put this in perspective, what I'm going to describe now is probably the best descriptor of how that plays out in a circumstance like this. So in spite of these horrific injuries, he's had his brain penetrated and his jaw and head have got wounds, and he's got all of these axe wounds all over his body, and his jaw's been horrifically damaged to the point where some of it isn't even there. He didn't actually immediately die for his wounds. In fact, what's astonishing, whether it's the result of adrenaline or whether it was indeed, and most likely was, to be honest, indeed part of the brain trauma he dealt with, the injuries that Peter had actually suffered just caused him to behave in a bizarre way the following morning. Because you'd imagine, wouldn't you, if you are still alive in the morning and you're literally bleeding out and dying of these horrific impact wounds, you're going to be hysterical. But no, because of course the brain needs to be interacting accurately and appropriately in those moments to inform you of these things. It seems that in spite of these catastrophic injuries, he gets up after waking up, he gets dressed, attempts to get on with his completely normal routine. He appeared completely oblivious, it seems, to the attacks that had taken place on him and his wife. And the belief is that that's because the area of controlling second nature activities hadn't actually been damaged. But the part of the brain that was able to self-identify as injured evidently had been damaged. So during this time where he's just going around his second nature activities, he had profusely bled from his wounds, which is why there was blood all over the rooms in the home. But in spite of this, in spite of bleeding out, he just carries on, prepares his breakfast, packs his lunch, even tries to load the dishwasher. He wrote a check for his son Christopher, because apparently there'd been some various parking fines that needed dealing with. So he'd done that. He even went outside to get a newspaper. Now, whilst he was outside, he locked himself out, but he even remembered where the spare key was hidden. So he managed to get back inside the house. Now, it does seem that during that, what could be seen as almost an absurd reaction to these catastrophic injuries, he did certainly lapse back into reality, because he did try to dial 911 on his house phone. But even though he did have that moment, it's likely that he kind of was either succumbing to his injuries at that point, or again, that second nature took over and he lost that conscious connection with the catastrophe he was dealing with on a personal level. So in the end, he just succumbs to those injuries, collapses, died of blood loss at the foot of the stairs. And what's really, really horrifyingly terrible about this is if he had managed to call for help or just stayed in bed, he may have survived, because it was the blood loss that had been so catastrophic for Peter. But it's just absolutely, as I said, both astonishing and awful. And I mean awful.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Thoughtful, as in it's an awe scenario where I look and I think, gosh, this man in such a terrible scenario, I'm filled with awe at his capacity, even in such dire circumstances, to continue. And I know that, like I said, I use the word absurd, not because he was absurd, but because of the fact that all the while his brain had just lost that function and focus on what really mattered in that moment, which was getting himself help. But I have this really weirdly deep respect for Peter, that he was just carrying on. And I do hope that when he died and he succumbed to that blood loss, that he wasn't in great pain at all. Now, Jonathan Porco, he's quickly ruled out as a suspect, because that's their older son. He's serving in the military. He had an absolutely solid alibi. They knew that there was absolutely no way he was anywhere near the home on that night. And you can't even imagine, can you? How would it be for Jonathan to get that call? I can't conceive psychologically of how somebody would manage that, to be told your parents are dead, but they're not just dead. We're not talking about a car crash, which is tragic enough. We're talking about somebody who's broken into their home and literally decimated their bodies. Yes, your mother is clinging on to life, but she has a chance that she's going to die, and whatever happens through her life-changing injuries. Because I imagine that for Jonathan, he was thinking neither were going to make it when he got the call. But at least they rule him out immediately, and he knows he's not under suspicion, and rightfully so. Now, given Joan's confirmation, because she's basically indicated that it's her younger son, Christopher, who'd carry out this brutal attack, the police then bring Christopher Porco for questioning. Throughout the interview, weird. That's what I'm going to say. Really odd. So first of all, he's really calm and emotionless. Bear in mind, why would you be calm and emotionless when you just found out that your mother's clinging on to life? She's lost an eye. She's got life-changing injuries. And your dad, he bled to death at the bottom of the stairs after being violently abused. How would you not connect? And I know that there are people out there that will say, well, you know what? Not everyone deals with emotions on the same spectrum. Of course they don't. But it is incredibly rare, no matter what the position, no matter what the disorder even, that we don't have some kind of reaction that is quantifiable and connected with the reality that they're experiencing. They may withdraw, they may appear very scared, they may appear very angry, they may appear hysterical, but there will be something that doesn't feel like there's just this moderate reality to their personal experience. Now, in spite of the fact that he's very calm and that he's able to just kind of talk, he claims that the reason that he definitely didn't kill anybody is, first of all, he wasn't there. And he also says that the reason that he can absolutely evidence that is he'd been 200 miles away, which was about 3 hours drive, on the night that his father's murder occurred. That was at Rochester's university campus, which is where he's meant to be studying. Now, he said it was only when somebody called him on the phone the following morning, it was a reporter apparently, that he gets informed of this tragedy that's affected his family. And of course, if Christopher Porco got that call, and it's not even by a police officer, and you know what? Boundaries. That's what I want to say to journalists like that. Boundaries. You should not be informing anybody about their parents' death. That's not your place. Stay away, back off. Your job is to report on the crime, not inform of the crime. But that's what he says. Somebody calls him, says what's happened, and they apparently said, do you know anything about your father's murder? If so, do you have a comment? Now, Porco, at this point with the police, outlines his movements for the investigators. And Christopher basically claims that the night that this horrible crime had occurred, he'd offered his bed to a visiting fraternity regional director, and that he offered him that comfort, essentially, to sleep there that night. So he himself had instead slept on the dorm couch. It's where you can watch TV. And he said he did that till about 1:30 a.m. and then just fell asleep. About 8 a.m, wakes up in the morning. And because his room was still in use at that moment, he'd then got up, gone for a 20-minute run. Then he'd returned, sat down, watched TV until about midday. I don't know. It's not sounding like there's a lot of studying going on there, Mr. Porco, throwing it out there. But this is what he says. He sat there till midday, and at this point, the regional director leaves. Then later that afternoon, it's around 3 p.m. in the afternoon, this reporter had told him about the attack. Now, he also, during this conversation, refused under any circumstances to believe that his mum had identified him as the perpetrator. On one level, that could indeed be because he was not the perpetrator. On another, it could be because he doesn't want the press to believe that he is the perpetrator. And evidence is that my mother would never say that to me. Because bear in mind, if he were the perpetrator, he's going to know how seriously injured she is. And potentially she might not pull through. So create that connection emotionally with my mother would never say that about me. Anyway, the investigation itself then ends up, in spite of having him identified by the very victim who identified him, it suffers a really big blow. Because Joan has this emergency surgery. Bear in mind, Joan's brain had been affected, her face had been affected. Surgery is highly traumatic, particularly after such a desperate scenario playing out in your world. So when she comes round, she gets conscious again. She says that she doesn't remember anything about the attack, but there's one thing she's absolutely 100% adamant about, and that is that her son could not be responsible. She said, listen, there is no way under any universe that he would have killed his dad. So at that point, she's just urging the police to find the true perpetrator, which you would fully understand, of course. She knows her son. She knows the relationship that her son has with the father. In her mind, there is absolutely no way, shape, or form that her beloved child could do anything so reprehensible, not just to him, but to her, the woman who gave birth to him. Now, later, she actually writes to an American newspaper stating this, and she's so stoic and committed to her belief in Christopher Porco. She says, I implore the Bethlehem police and the district attorney's office to leave my son alone and to search for Peter's real killer or killers so that he can rest in peace and my sons and I can live in safety. Which is fully understandable because as far as she is concerned, there's no way her kids would have done it to her. These people have potentially broken in, destroyed the life as she knew it, and now everyone's focusing in on her kid. And she's thinking, geez, guys, can you please go out and get the right person so I can just actually go to sleep at night and not be completely traumatized and terrified by the possibility and potential that they're going to come back? It's totally understandable that that's where her mind goes. Now, also, to add to the fact that Christopher Porco is now being told to the police that he's not the killer by mother, they can't find any forensic evidence linking him to the crime. They say that tape had been placed around the murder weapon during the commission of the attack, and that's basically been removed, and that meant there were no fingerprints on the axe. Also, they believe that the killer wore disposable gloves during the commission of the offence. And meanwhile, the forensic examination of Porco's car revealed literally no traces of blood. Now, considering the brutality of the attack that I've talked about, you would expect to find something. Blood spatter doesn't have to be visible, and it certainly can contact-orientated transfer. So you would expect to see this. Now, despite Christopher Porco's mother saying, look, it wasn't my son, and also there being absolutely no forensic detail or whatsoever to connect Christopher Porco with the crime, he does remain the investigator's prime suspect, which you would. Sorry, I laughed then. I'm not laughing at the crime. I'm not laughing at the mother who doesn't believe that he is responsible. I'm kind of laughing at the fact that why wouldn't you still keep the eye on that individual? The woman came round and was able to specifically rule out her eldest son, but specifically to agree that her youngest son was the person responsible. And it's only after the surgery that this belief system has diminished. And you have to add to that as well a whole heap of parental bias. Honestly, I think for any mother and father out there, unless you've had a very sinister child, the logistics of bringing them up is that if they walked in and told you that they were innocent of something and you have never seen anything in their background before to connect them with the possibility of being malevolent, you are going to fully believe them. That's a completely normal reality, I think, for the vast majority of us parents. There'll be some parent out there now going, no. I watch too many true crime shows. I watch too many, I'd probably be the one taking him to the police station and saying, I don't remember anything, but it's probably him. I've seen a lot of these crime films. So anyway, he's the major suspect still. And so they start looking into his background. And when they do that, it does not diminish. It's not like they're like looking into the background and going, God, honestly, guys, I can't believe we looked at Christopher Porco and actually believed that he was possible of this brutality. I have looked into his background and I swear to God, at the end of it, Mother Teresa looked like a cow compared to him. And Mother Teresa is not a cow. She's a saint. That didn't happen at all. No. And the more that they look into Christopher Porco's background, well, the more convinced they are that they've absolutely got the right guy. So first of all, his background reveals that he's a pathological liar. He's manipulative, devious. He's an individual whose life is literally a web of lies. It's just a tapestry of deception, it really is. Someone who would, I believe at least, and I'm sure that many others concur, he would do whatever he needed to achieve whatever goals he had. literally no remorse about any of the consequences. If he saw something and he wanted it and you were standing in that way, you better be ready to get bulldozed. That kind of psychology, that kind of mentality. So before we go any further to actually talk about how this plays out in the long term, let's go back to who Christopher Porco was. So he was born on the 9th of July, 1983, grew up in Delmar. That's with his parents, Peter and John, and his older brother, Jonathan. Now, Peter, he was an attorney. Joan was a school speech therapist, and Jonathan was an officer in the US Navy. So we're talking about really successful human beings here, and I'm putting Jonathan's job in the Navy there because of the fact that it's always good to look at a sibling because there is some expectation, although genetics obviously play a massive part in how we end up. It's also quite cool to be able to look at a sibling and go, yeah, nothing to see here. A very nice man, works in the US Navy. I will tell you as well, from what I've learned about Jonathan, he's a very bright and discerning individual. He has a really high moral compass from what I can find. Now, Porco, on the other hand, he works part-time as a veterinary assistant. So I guess that we can say he has some kind of at least rudimentary understanding of the human body and potentially also how to deal with pretty bloody situations. Just throwing it out there and posing the question at this moment in time. I imagine working in a vet sort of medical area of any type, particularly a hospital or a theatre and a veterinary surgeons, could lead to you knowing some things about cleaning things up. Just throwing it out there. Now, as a young person, Porco was quite popular, to be fair. He was co-captain of the swim team at Bethlehem High School. He graduated in 2002, and he was known to be intelligent, but he didn't apply himself fully to academia. So even though he could have probably thrived and done really, really well, it wasn't necessarily his interest area. So he could do okay, but let's just say maybe he had interests elsewhere. Now, Porco definitely displayed signs of antisocial personality disorder from a really young age. So let's go through a bit of this. He stole property from his parents on two occasions. That's not okay. So in November 2003, he staged a burglary at his parents' home and stole two laptops. Later, he actually sold one of them on eBay. I know, the thing about these super clever criminals is often they're super stupid, aren't they, when it comes down to actually being sophisticated over how the crime plays out in the long term. eBay, not the best idea. Kind of tracks directly back to you, you know, with a picture of the item and a payment detail to you. Worth noting though, when he did this, his brother's eBay accounts were actually frozen because the account used the same address in Delmar. Now that transpired that Porco had actually been, when he was doing this whole scenario of stealing laptops and selling one of them on eBay, that he got a bit of a, I don't know, a taste for it. Ooh, I could sell these items that I've stolen, or I could be even more creative. I could be a little bit more creative than that. What I'll do is I'll list items that I'm gonna sell that don't actually exist. Yeah, so he'd taken people's money, but he hadn't actually sent them their goods. And incredibly, but unsurprisingly, shall we say, he'd even pretended to be his older brother and advised one customer that the account holder had died. I mean, that is worse than the dog ate my homework. Actually, people who have dogs, it's not often an excuse, is it? Because dogs do genuinely get books, root them up and eat the homework. But what I'm saying is very immature and childish, but also relatively effective. What are you going to do if you bought something from somebody who's now dead? How do you even know how to handle that? And using his brother in that way, again, I'm going to say that I find it really distasteful, but also quite an insight into somebody's character when they're quite happy to pretend that somebody close to them is dead. I know by saying that somebody has died won't actually mean that they die. I just have a few superstitions and I don't think we should do that with our family members. But he's just thinking very egocentrically, isn't he? He doesn't really care about the consequences for his brother and he certainly wants to get out of that scenario quickly, and just saying that he's died in his head clearly solves the problem. Also, Porco doesn't just stop with his family when it comes down to this kind of malevolent and dire behavior. He even goes ahead and steals items for his employer and sells them on eBay, which is about as poor consequential thinking as one can ever imagine. It also shows a great level of arrogance, superiority, and a belief that getting found out does not really matter at all. So I don't think for one second he was that concerned about the consequences. If he got found out, I'm sure he would have believed that he could have talked himself out of that situation. Now, investigators, they actually are able to also establish that the relationship between Porco and his parents had actually been really deteriorating. And yes, they should have been. Personally, if you had nicked my laptops after staging a robbery in my home, I think at that point the deterioration would have been grave. Because I just find that kind of behaviour really dirty. And I think on a relational level, to be able to put your parents through the trauma and stress of believing they've had a home invasion just so you can make a quick buck, it denies any accountability and denies any responsibility for the care and consideration that you should have for the people that have brought you up and that love you. Now, the reason for this deterioration continuing is they were actually a really close family, but Porco more and more and more was becoming a disappointment to his parents. And he deserves to become a disappointment to his parents. You don't do the stuff that he's doing without expecting a little bit of disappointment. Some of you out there will be like, disappointed, Emma. There's a few other words. I wouldn't be more disappointed. I'd have packed his bags and kicked him out. You know, there are people who feel that strongly. But one of the main issues that the family have is that he isn't doing well in his examinations and they want what's best for him. They want him to succeed. So we get to autumn 2003. And at this point, he's actually dropped from his biomedical engineering and economics course, which is at the University of Rochester. So these are big deals. It costs a lot of money to go to university in the States. And if mum and dad are funding that, then that's going to be a problem for them. And if you're dropping out and then there are consequential bills coming in for that, and you're just doing what he does next, which is to just enroll in a computing course at Hudson Valley Community College, understandably, more money is being spent. So he ends up getting poor scores there as well. And his parents find out. And at this point, they're really, really furious. And there's actually an email that was sent to Porco in March 2004. And they just demand an explanation. In fact, the message that is entitled, so when he sees it without even opening it, it says, failing grades, you did it again. I appreciate no child wants to get a message like that off a parent. It's triggering and upsetting because you know that they know something about your lies and also your failures. But hey, it's normal and natural, and there is nothing worse for a parent than to believe that you've lied to them. It's a thing that all young people should be taught from a really young age. Just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. It will be bad immediately, but you'll get a lot of respect for it in the long term and it won't damage relationships. There is nothing worse than lying and lying and lying. And in the end, it snowballs and it affects you and everyone else around you. And worse than that, everyone finds out anyway. You just elongate the amount of time it takes and you amplify the pain it causes. Now, at the point that he receives this email, he's touring Europe with his girlfriend, as you do. You know, I'm failing everything. I'm stealing. I'm eBaying people's goods that don't exist and taking money from innocent customers. I've killed my brother in this whole scenario in my head to cope. And now the way I'm going to manage my conscience and the consequences of my poor actions is to go away and just tour Europe, which is very expensive. So he's away there with friends as well as his girlfriend. So instead of taking this responsibility, he just gets back to his mother and father and he's like, no. You have received some information about me. And that information from an academic establishment that will send these out all the time, it's wrong. Is it wrong though? Because you keep lying to us and failing and basically scraping through or losing your opportunities academically because you just can't be bothered. I promise you, all of that was in the past. Now I am an exemplary student. Don't worry about it. I've done very well. I shall rectify this mistake. And he did. He did. He claims that the lowest grade that he got was a B, which means that most of them he'd have got would be an A, which is pretty damn fine if that's true, but it's not. Because he just is like, well, I haven't really got these, so what I'll do is I'll just forge documents from the college that suggests I got very high scores in my exams. But parents would want to believe that. I mean, who wants to think that they have such a manipulative of a child, such a devious human being that they've born? It's a horrible feeling. Now, at this point, he manages to get himself re-enrolled at the University of Rochester. And again, the lies just continue. So he says, listen, the university have actually agreed to cover my tuition fees. I mean, gonna throw it out there. I'm just saying that if my kid had constantly failed and had, shall we say, a little penchant for the old Porky Pig, you know, a little bit of a lie here and there, I don't know whether I'd have been taking it very seriously when he said that. You know what, it's cool. Our tutor lost my final exam paper, so they're just going to pay my tuition fees. In what universe does that happen? In what if that was a universe where this stuff happened, I can guarantee at the end of term, when the teacher is, you know, I don't know, tidying the drawers out, you'd be like, you know what you need? You need to go for a nice restful coffee. Why don't I look after all your exam papers, one of which is mine? I've done very, 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 very well. Yes, Donna, escort her to the cafeteria. We shall buy you a Twix as well. As she leaves, set yours on fire. University fees sorted. Obviously, there'd be a problem. Miss would be very popular and there'd be a line of about 70 kids all ready to do that. But again, he's clearly very adept at telling these ridiculous lies. But in truth, Porco's actually planning to borrow his fees. And he's going to borrow it from the worst place possible. It's not exactly the worst place possible, because a loan shark would be the worst place possible, because I think they can run and literally break your legs. But it's near that. He goes for a high interest $31,000 loan. Also, it was a loan that his parents didn't even know he'd taken out. And even worse, he had literally listed his own dad as a co-signer without his permission. Now, Porco also then... Because I guess what we could say is, well, this is awful. This is really bad. It's really quite malevolent. It's certainly very deceptive. However, he's afraid that his parents are going to be disappointed. He's thinking desperately about how to resolve this issue. He wants to succeed and make them proud. And he's making a terrible, terrible decision doing this. But even though it feels enormous, I suppose there is a level of being forgiven in the future if it all comes good in the end. But that's not what we're talking about. Because Porco also takes out a further loan to buy a brand new yellow Wrangler Jeep. And again, he uses his father's name as a co-signer without his consent. Now, in total, he used his father's credit information to take out more than $45,000 in loans, which is enormous. And also, when you get yourself in a situation like that, you know it's coming. You know someone's going to find out. The question is, does that really bother you? Do you really have that level of care? Or is this simply about getting what you can from these people because they're not your parents, they're just objects to be used? Now, his father's a clever guy, so it doesn't take him very long at all to find out about the loans. He begins receiving notices from credit agencies, and this is all indicating that Porco is not paying his bills. Also, at the same time, he receives a notice from his university stating his university tuition hadn't been paid. So Peter will be absolutely incensed. So he threatens to contact the bank. He says he's going to get him to be removed as co-signer. He also says, listen, because he knows his stuff, remember, we're talking about him being a lawyer. So he says, if you carry on down this road, I am going to file a forgery affidavit to absolve me of any liability in relation to your loans, which I think would be the absolute right thing to do. And he actually wrote to him and he said, Chris, I found out yesterday that you also obligated me on the car loan by signing my name to the check used to purchase the Jeep. I got the paperwork from Citibank and confirmed it with a check of my credit history. That being the case, I immediately paid the October and November 2004 payments to bring the loan current so that no default is reported on my account. I want you to know that if you abuse my credit again, I'll be forced to file forgery affidavits in order to disclaim liability. And that applies to the Citibank college loan if you attempt to reactivate it or to use my credit to obtain any other loan without my express knowledge and permission. Also, American Express keeps calling me, but won't discuss anything with me, so I presume that you're in trouble there too. Things are obviously spinning out of control with you. I think you should come home so we can talk. Listen, we may be disappointed in you, but your mother and I still love you and care about your future. We can't help you problem solve without information and input from you, Dad. I mean, genuinely, it breaks my heart reading you that, because all I can see there is what lovely parents they are. Even though there's anger in the tone, it's constructive anger. It's all about, look, this is the problem. Let's figure out a solution. But you can't keep on doing this, using me, attacking me, affecting me. Let me help you. We love you. And I think the graciousness of that actual statement is blindsiding as far as I'm concerned. It just shows what humans they were, as in truly humane, because I don't even know whether somebody who, like myself, has practiced compassionate parenting my entire life, I'm not sure that I could hold such restraint in such circumstances. Now, the family who've just sent this, as I say, gracious and helpful message, they just get ignored by Porco. He ignores their emails and calls. And in fact, he ignores those emails and calls, full stop. And 2 weeks later, his father would be dead and his mother would be left fighting for her life. Now, of course, the investigators want to get their man. And it's not too difficult, I'll be honest, to start picking apart Porco's alibi. So remember, he claimed to be at his university dorm all night. However, students who were there, his fellow students, they said, nah, not true at all. He was not sleeping in the dorm lounge on the night of the attack, because lots of the students who were there had actually been watching films in the common area and Porco hadn't been there. Also, because like I said, nothing like one of these individuals who think they're super clever, are they? Because the security cameras, literally the security cameras, you know, the ones that actually have cameras that take pictures and moving images of individuals who are leaving or coming back, throwing out there, you'd imagine they'd have planned for that, wouldn't you? So they record that a yellow Jeep Wrangler, which, let's be honest, the bright colour. If you're gonna do a crime, I would imagine that bright yellow would not be the choice for the average criminal. A little bit ostentatious, isn't it? So they see this Jeep Wrangler leaving the campus at 10:30 p.m. on the 14th of November 2004. Also, the investigators were able to obtain surveillance footage from toll booths along the highway, literally tracking his journey. So this is between Bethlehem and Rochester. So it captures as well that the same vehicle with Porco's distinctive yellow Jeep, so to speak, passing through the New York State toll. And the collector actually confirms, yeah, it's a bright yellow Jeep. That's how unusual it is. We don't see many of them around. And this Jeep Wrangler had passed through his station about 10:45 p.m. And the toll collector in Albany, they also stated that the yellow Jeep Wrangler had approached and it was going at a really excessive speed. And that was just before 2 a.m. on the 15th of November. Also, I don't know, he's not really thought about this, has he? His DNA was found on a toll ticket. So that proved that he was driving the Jeep that night. Now, meanwhile, the neighbour of the Porco family, they'd actually seen Porco's yellow Jeep in the driveway on the evening of the attack, while security cameras at the University of Rochester.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Also captured a yellow Jeep returning later that morning at 8:30 a.m. I'm not sure where his alibi is. I am asleep. I was asleep in the dorm lounge. I don't think you were. I was asleep in the dorm lounge. No one saw you there. I was asleep and quiet. You can't be asleep and quiet in a room and still not be visible. You're not invisible, are you? I blend in with furniture. But your car doesn't, does it? Your bright yellow Wrangler Jeep doesn't. I think there are a few of those around. With you driving it, with you in it, I think you're stretching it a little. Your DNA is on a ticket on the way to your parents' house, and your neighbour saw your Wrangler yellow Jeep in the driveway. I was asleep on a couch. It's all coincidence. Even the CCTV that sees me leaving and coming back. And I'm sticking to that story. I mean, I don't know where to start with that, do you? I'd like to start in the interview and interrogation room, just throwing it out there. And on top of that, if it wasn't enough already to have all that information and to be thinking, yes, I don't think we're going to be walking away from this, Mr. Porco. He genuinely doesn't seem to care whatsoever and is just lying and lying and lying. And if it weren't enough to have all of that evidence I've just talked about, the investigators also established that the family home alarm had actually been used and disabled using the master 4-digit code, which was a code that was only known to family members. So even though it had been smashed up, it was irrelevant, it had been turned off. So the police at this point are more convinced than ever that Porco's carried out the attack, and it's not an unknown intruder at all. He's made it look like a burglary wrong, but authorities genuinely believe that he went with one intention, and that was the whole premise was to murder his parents and to stage this burglary, essentially. I think that's what's incredibly telling about this crime as well, because if he's planned it, and he's planned to do it in this way, and to make it look like it has been a random home invasion where people died, it's because he fully intends to get away with it. He's future focusing. This isn't Porco killing them in a rage. This is Porco killing them for gain. He wants his parents to die so that he can solve his substantial debt problems. So he planned essentially to benefit from his parents' life insurance policies. And the investigators suspected that he had made a 3-hour journey from the University of Rochester to his parents' home, that he'd set off at 10:30 p.m. on the 14th of November, driven to Delmar. He arrived in the early hours on the 15th of November, but once he'd arrived at his parents' home, he then deactivated the alarm using that 4-digit code. Then he smashed the alarm box, as I said, because he wanted to make it look like somebody was trying to disable it. And then that was around 2:14 a.m. in the morning, in the early hours. At this point, he goes into his parents' home, into his parents' bedroom. He'd be sleeping, of course. And then he just attacks them with the axe as they slept. Then he cut the phone line. This was at 4:59 a.m. And again, that is because he wants to make it look like, oh, well, I don't want anybody to be able to call the emergency services. And that's what a burglar would do. And then he returned to his university campus. Now, even though on one level we can say, oh, he tried to stage that as a burglary and there's some kind of linearity to how he does it. Doesn't make sense at all, does it? A burglar who is going to burgle, cutting the phone lines isn't likely to be the thing that they'd be thinking of, because you cut the phone lines because you don't want somebody to get some help. And on one level, you can say, okay, well, that could be genuinely down to the fact that they want to buy time. But a home invasion usually wants to be completely separate from the people in the home. They want to kind of creep around and get what they need. The smashing of the alarm system, all of these things, it doesn't really fit in with that random home invasion. They tend to be opportunistic and they certainly don't seem to plan things in this way. And also, of course, the big blindingly obvious issue is that, let's be honest, no one took anything. So that denies a burglary could have been the motivation. So after this has all happened, he then returns to the university campus and that's when he arrives back about 8:30 a.m. Investigators then speak to his neighbours, and one of the things that they said that really struck them, knowing that this absolutely heinous killing had taken place next door, is they didn't hear the dog bark. So the Porcos had a Labrador dog, and if a dog doesn't know the person coming in, and actually a lot of dogs, when they do know the person coming in, my dogs bark whenever I walk in after being out, there's just that moment where they're like, oh, it's you. But the fact that the Labrador dog doesn't bark, that's going to be unusual. It suggests that the dog knew the person who'd entered the home. And bearing in mind that the dog would have been aware potentially that the owner was being viciously attacked, you'd certainly expect some kind of barking. And so the investigators even further now believe that they've got Porco, that this is the man. Now, the final incriminating piece of evidence, and it's, as far as I am concerned, the pièce de résistance. He'd sought financial advice just before the attack, and he'd actually told an investment advisor that he was going to come into some money. That's really strange. I appreciate he's a massive liar anyway, so if he was talking to somebody who was an investment advisor, he could just be blowing smoke up their ass, so to speak, and saying that he's going to need their services and trying to ingratiate himself to them and inflate his own ego. But I don't think that's the case. It just all ties in far too tightly and neatly, doesn't it? And I think that's what's truly shocking about what I'm talking about today. The level of premeditation and the willingness to destroy the very people who gave you life and gave you a good life as well. So the investigators are absolutely convinced this guy is more than just a Walter Mitty who just makes stuff up. This guy's life is a web of deceit. They even established that he lied to his fellow students. So he kind of talked himself up, said he came from a wealthy family with an oceanfront home. He claimed that his dad was a successful high-paid attorney. Also claimed that he was set to receive $2.8 million as a gift from his grandmother. Everybody would like a grandmother like that. She doesn't exist, but everybody would like a grandmother like that. $2.8 million would be a very nice gift. I mean, I like soap. Quite happy with that. If he gave me 2.8 million, I don't know what I'd do. Cry for a month probably and then get up off the floor and be very grateful. Anyway, Porco is then ultimately arrested on suspicion of murder and attempted murder, and he absolutely should be. Now, the problem that we've got here is, even though it seems like he's really bound to rights, and a lot of you will be thinking, well, how could this possibly be a questionable case? Because there seems to be this shed load of evidence, but it's quite circumstantial, bizarrely. First of all, there's no actual eyewitnesses placing him at the scene. Remember, there was no forensic evidence that ties him to the crime. I mean, they have the DNA on the toll ticket, but that doesn't tie him to the actual crime scene. However, what the investigators do discover is, bear in mind what I said earlier, Porco had a part-time job at a veterinarian's, and the vet says, listen, we trained him in cleaning up after animal surgeries. And so this, the investigators believe, is why there was no forensic evidence. So then we get to the trial. Of course we do. And his trial commenced on the 27th of June, 2006. This is in Orange County. Now, the prosecution lay out the timeline to the jury. And the prosecution argue that this proves that he is absolutely guilty. Look, he's not where he said he was. This bright yellow Wrangler Jeep. Just remember that, criminals. Not the best colour. Go for a grey, a dark blue, a black, or, most importantly, don't do crime at all. But the point is, they can kind of indicate the way that it's travelled, they've got the toll ticket, they've got the neighbour seeing that his car's there. But the defence, well, they say, hey, that doesn't mean that he killed anybody. And actually what they say is that there was a really strong possibility that it was his uncle who was in prison. Essentially, his uncle had been accused of being a snitch. He'd told the police information about his criminal underworld ties, and the consequence was that somebody in retribution came back to ensure that, let's just say, he wouldn't be giving any more information to anybody that asked for it. And there would be this way of killing his family to prove to him that there were consequences to his loose lips. So yeah, his great uncle Frank Porco, he was a loan shark, ironically. Don't know why he didn't go to him. No, he didn't go to him because he was in prison. But he was also a captain in the Bonanno New York crime family. And because of the fact that they believed that he was going to snitch, he was talking, the mob associates attacked Peter and Joan just to warn them. Also, Frank Porco's nickname was the Fireman. So they used that as a tie to the weapon that the murderers had actually used, the axe, a fire axe. But come on. I mean, that's stretching it, isn't it? You imagine them, can't you, in the prosecution and defence scenario. The prosecution's like, I don't think we need any additional help, even though it seems circumstantial. When you add it together, it's like a map of the obvious. And the defence are sitting there going, we've got nothing. Well, I mean, there's always something. What is it? What's the something? Well, I found out that there's some kind of like mob links, and apparently the guy's going to potentially snitch, and apparently he's called the Fireman. I like where you're going with this. We're going to say that the Fireman, it's symbolic of the fire axe. I think so. That's why we hired you for your work experience. When you go back to school next week, you feel proud of yourself, kid. Anyway, just saying. Theory seems a little bit on the unlikely side. Frank Porco was actually in prison at the time, but he was actually refusing to cut the deal and to rat on the mob. So even though the suspicions and suggestions were that he was somebody with loose lips who was snitching, in reality, he wasn't. He was super sensible. Didn't want a member of his family, I don't know, to wake up next to a horse head in the bed, which annoys me. Why should the horse suffer? They have not got any mafia ties. Don't understand it. Not that I'm suggesting it's an appropriate head to put there. Just avoid taking people or animals' heads off, per se. Now, what's really heartbreaking for me, but also, it doesn't surprise me at all, I think that Porco's mum and dad are rare. I think they are unconditional in their love. And I know his father's no longer here, but you could see that before in the way that he wrote to his son, letting him know that no matter how bad things were, it could be sorted. And similarly, Porco's mother, who initially identified the fact that he was her attacker, because she woke up with no memory, she just believed that her son was the son she'd always, in her mind, known. She stood beside him throughout the entire proceedings. She raised $250,000 for his bail. He even moved home with her whilst he awaited trial. She even walked into court with him arm in arm. She testified in his defence. She even accused the police of bungling the investigation and charging the wrong person. So it's something quite profound about this mother's love. I don't necessarily believe that she is approaching this without a bias, because she has loved him and brought him into this world. And maybe even the stretch to imagine that she's taken the man that she loved from her. It must be an incredible dichotomy to try to travel between those two points of reference in your head. It's like cognitive dissonance. But this is a child I love. But this is a child who tried to kill me. But this is a child I love. And you're going to end up on one side. And she obviously chooses a side of absolute love and defence. We get to the 10th of August, 2006. You won't be surprised to find out that the jury find Porco guilty of second-degree murder and attempted murder. On the 12th of December 2006, Porco gets sentenced to 50 years to life on each count. That means he has to serve a minimum of 50 years in prison. When you think about Porco, wow, I'm gonna throw it out there, guys. Definitely demonstrates signs of sociopathic and psychopathic mindsets. Highly narcissistic. Used others for his own means, even his family. Constantly lied, despite the fact that everyone found out.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
About it. There was no way he was going to get around that. He forged his father's signature, took out large loans, forged his own exam scores to get readmitted to a university course. He'd stolen from his parents previously, he'd stolen from his employer, he'd sold goods on eBay, he'd defrauded eBay customers by taking money, not giving them the goods, he'd pretended to his brother, and then he pretended his brother was dead, and he constantly lied to people around him about who he was and what his wealth was like. And it's weird because you see all of that, but it's almost like this really began a little bit later to some degree. So it was really when he began university that it seems like he'd lived a life without consequences. And because he'd been able to get away with quite a lot and he'd been taken care of and looked after and loved in the ways that he had, that suddenly being there out on his own to some degree in that transition, that's when the lies start to catch up with him. But it's not just that that we're talking about. As well as him being manipulative, deceptive in his behaviour, he was capable of, wow, such extreme violence. He butchered his parents in an unimaginably brutal way. All that mattered to that very much loved son, is that he solved his money problems. And it didn't matter that that came above the lives of his parents. Now, since his incarceration, Porco, who's actually 39 now, he's unsuccessfully attempted to appeal his conviction on two occasions. Unsurprisingly, Mr. Porco, it's because, one, you tell a lot of porky pigs. Sorry, it does feel like quite a connection there. Porco and Porky. Just throwing it out there. But also, it's clear the breadcrumb trail to the killings lies within his steps. It really does. So I'm unsurprised he hasn't been able to appeal his conviction. And he currently resides at Clinton Correctional Facility in New York. He will be eligible for parole in December 2052. He'll be 69 then. Now his brother, bring him in again, because I think his brother is discerning. His brother's successful. His brother did things the right way. He actually has described the relationship he has with Porco as icy. Always being convinced of his guilt. But his mother, his victim, she continues to maintain his innocence. And I think, and I don't mean to judge her in any way, the hell that she has been through, it's enormous. I can't compute how to hold what's happened to her in my mind without instantly feeling the anxiety and conflict that she must endure. But her other son is saying, "Mum, no, he's guilty." And the problem in those dynamics is support your child in prison, even forgive your child for killing your partner, but don't ignore the child who has been an upstanding, positive, pro-social member of our community. Don't deny the worth of their reality and feelings, because even though you're not seeming to pick one over the other, to some degree you are. For his brother, he's done nothing wrong. He's lost his father. He's had to witness his brother go to prison for the brutal murder and the all but murder of his own mother. And yet she stands beside him, completely convinced of his innocence. I hope over time she's able to work on that mindset and understand that you can love an individual who's done the most heinous of things to people that you love. You can forgive them, albeit that you can't forget their action. You can accept that you can still feel and care and be within their life. It says something profound about you, in fact. But to hold on to the innocence, to buy into a bias because it hurts you more, because you've lost so much already. If it denies your other child the justice that they deserve, to be able to say, "Mum, my brother killed my father. He needs to pay." Then you take something really important and precious from him. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.